Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb, and today I am joined by my father, Dr. Scott Keith, for another Q&A episode as we are between books inside the Lutheran Confessions and also planning some long-term content with more of the fellows. We are scheduling Adam Francisco to come back on the show.
Back from, I won't say the dead, but back from obscurity.
Back from obscurity. You know, he has made himself difficult to get a hold of for anything but annoying text messages. So, but we'll get him back. Episodes in November are going to feature the full cast plus guests from throughout the fellowship, especially those that live in California.
Wowza.
So look forward to that. That's over a month away for people listening today, but those are scheduled, so we probably will go on to a confession before those. I thought we were going to try to get those in, but we're working with Adam's schedule here, so November it will have to be. But today we're going to take a moment, answer a couple more questions. You know, last week we didn't have enough time to get to all of the good questions that we had stacked up, and we had some that I thought needed some longer response to, and thank you for to those of you who have contacted me back after listening to those episodes that you got the answer, and I will work on some of those emails this week as well. So here we go.
Oh, here we go.
All right. So the first one, how do you want to do this? You want to do the one related to the confessions topic first, or do you want to do that one last?
I'm easy. Do whatever you want.
Okay. Well, why don't we just do like a unique topic first here for this? And this is, we got a general email to the podcast network. This person did not say which podcast they were listening to, but I have a feeling it was probably ours, because I feel like this topic has come up specifically before. And that is, the question goes, it's difficult for me to approach Christian interactions with culture without, apart from describing contrasting worldviews and dealing with those contrasting worldviews. The team at 1517 seems to be hesitant to use worldview methodology when it comes to critiquing or dealing with culture. Can you describe why you're hesitant to do that, and also critique the use of, you know, worldview sort of methodology when it comes to Christians engaging culture?
Yeah, that's a really good question. That's very, and whoever this person is, wow, you're insightful. That's good. Here's the thing that so typically when you're engaging worldview, you're doing that sort of for the purpose of apologetics, right? You're trying to defend the faith in some way, shape, or form, or defend one of the practices of the faith in some way, shape, or form, and that is sometimes hard to do without a compare and contrast kind of deal set up. When we do apologetics specifically, we usually use a more, I guess I'd call it, positive tactic. In other words, where we're presenting a case rather than tearing down a case. Now there is a method of doing apologetics that typically does exactly that. Sort of tears down the secular worldview for the purpose of then presenting the Christian worldview as the alternative, and then kind of presuming the truth of the Bible when presenting that Christian worldview to other people, to even secular people. And one of the reasons we don't do it is because it's most helpful, type of thing is most helpful in conversations with unbelievers. And we would typically believe that unbelievers don't presume the truthfulness of the Bible. And so any sort of Christian worldview you're presenting, you're going to present it from the presumption of, I know this from the scriptures, and the scriptures are true. Thus, this is the true way to live, dot, 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 dot. If you don't presume that they believe the truthfulness of the Bible or will give it any credibility whatsoever, you're then kind of stuck in, okay, how do I get them to that point? Well, we'd say you get that to them to that point by presenting the positive case for Christ, right, specifically from the four Gospels, and then moving out from there. Now, I don't think it's wrong to sort of, in conversations with people, to sort of present the Christian worldview versus the non-Christian worldview. And the fact is, we do some of that. Like I did a whole YouTube series last year on Bruce Hillman on postmodernism, I think it was 10 episodes, which drove me crazy.
I'll see if I can, I have the links to that, so yeah. We can get that on there.
Where he very much sort of made, playing devil's advocate, made the postmodern case, and I very much critiqued it, using basically Christian truth and Christian belief, and other things too, just, you know, plain reasoning sometimes too. And so it's just not our go-to. Our go-to historically is more the evidential case for Christ first. And then once somebody sort of, this is C.S. Lewis's sort of the different view of the house that is Christianity. The house, the view that you have from outside the house is a much different view that you have from inside the house. And so we usually try to get people inside the house before we sort of construct the worldview that is being a Christian. I'm going to say one more thing and then let you go, but Lutherans typically do this differently too. We talked about this a little bit last week. We typically do this a little bit more vocationally than we do sort of just worldview-y. So it's I think within Catholicism, this would be called more like subsidiarity type stuff, where we talk very much about your world, you know, what the people that God has called into your world, your family, your community, your job, right. Your church, on and on, rather than sort of global secular world versus global Christian world.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I think working with everything you said, I agree. There'd be a couple reasons that people would typically use worldviews. One of those would be apologetics, and the other one is a different type of apologetics, but in the sense of what you described as the apologetics that we would say we attempt to do is essentially tearing down roadblocks so that the gospel can be presented. Correct. And proclaimed.
Yeah.
It's not to make wholesale Christianity and Christendom appealing. It's to take an objection,
show people Christ.
Address the objection, and particularly address that, like, the resurrection occurred. That's the big one.
Yep.
There's a different type of Christian apologetics which takes assails, maybe even persecution, from the world and is essentially trying to either justify why that persecution is happening and why Christians are right, or sort of try to convince the culture on this one point from the perspective of a wholesale Christian world that makes more sense,
right?
And is more consistent.
Yeah, and internally consistent, especially.
I do think one of the problems of the presuppositionalist worldview approach, though, is that you do have to acknowledge that because people manage to function and governments and organizations who aren't Christian manage to function, succeed, do well, live happy, peaceful lives from birth till death to a similar extent that Christians do, that almost every worldview is internally consistent. And even the ones that aren't internally consistent, they manage to, you know, deal with those in a way that lets them live their lives still drive their car across the road.
I'd be clear. And see, the third reason we don't do this a lot is because it's very difficult to do it without getting political.
Correct.
And we try to not get political almost at any cost, even when sort of we get criticized for it. But here's the thing. It's hard to say that we haven't lost something in this country because of a loss of sort of a Judeo-Christian view of things. Even if when people weren't Christian necessarily, they had a Judeo-Christian familiarity with Bible text and with stories, and even sort of with the worldview, whether or not they completely agreed to it or adhered to it or not, they had a familiarity with it. Now, one of the things that just as a student of history that you can honestly say is that democracies or republic democracies like ours only work when there's a shared set of values between people, because even the whole system of a democracy or republic is set up on arguing with one another. And if you can't argue with one another while still believing that on the whole you share at least a core set of values, things start to fall apart, which is possibly what we're seeing right now, right? With stuff seeming to fall apart, is that we very easily gave up that shared set of values, and it's trying to be replaced with what is essentially sort of a brand of, even if you go down to critical race theory or just even critical theory, which is a brand of postmodernism, which doesn't know how to build value. It only knows how to take away value. And That's absolutely true about postmodern thought. Is that postmodern thought
is about deconstruction, yeah, not about reconstruction.
Its gift is critique and deconstruction. Its gift is not building anything. Now, since we're now not building a common set of values, Christian or otherwise, things are getting more difficult.
Yeah, I think there's also a, and one of the reasons this is hard is there is a separation between what the mission of the church is and the proclamation of Christ and what makes my life better here in the United States today.
In the here and now.
And while...
Great sermon on that, at least touched on that, by Bob Hiller yesterday at Community Lutheran Church Escondido.
I do have the link to that. I can post that. You know, and I would say there are many things about my life that I complain about on a daily basis, just ask my dad, that would be better in a Christian, like in a world that was politically Christian.
Mm-hmm.
Like 100%. But there's a part of me that has to lay the fight down for that ease of my life if it means that is going to cause me to reject or not proclaim the gospel to certain people.
Or in our case, at 15-17, to reject our primary purpose, which is the proclamation of the gospel of Christ Jesus.
Right.
So we make a choice, right? Especially on this show, I'd say we make a choice. Proclamation of Christ Jesus by means of explaining sound doctrine, sound philosophical principles in church history, with as little or no sort of, hey, this is how you lead your political life. You're talking three estates. I'm not talking about the family here because we talk a lot about that, but literally the political estate. And it's difficult to get into sort of deconstructing a secular worldview without sort of propping up a Christian political view. Mm-hmm. Now, again, it's not like I disagree with having a Christian political view. I don't. It's just not the purpose of what we do.
Yeah, of this particular organization. And again, to go back to vocationally, though, it's like I would encourage people to act politically within the bounds that we
absolutely
that we've been given.
That's a gift of vocation, right? That's a gift of being in the political estate.
There's an election in California tomorrow.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go participate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're just not on this show gonna tell you how to vote.
Right.
Yes, go participate.
Which is I wanna say, which is funny, my phone has been blowing up with texts about the recall election tomorrow. I've probably gotten 15 in the last 5 days because I'm registered to vote here in California. And three of them have been videos in a text message. Pastor so-and-so has an important message for you about fighting for your faith tomorrow at the polls.
Yeah, so you'll Pastor, never get that from 15-17.
Yeah, we're not going to send that.
Yeah. We send you a video, it's going to be like, did you see this guy as he proclaimed the truth of the gospel of Christ Jesus?
And tomorrow's a recall election, right? And so whoever the governor is tomorrow, by the end of this election tomorrow, doesn't change.
Well, after all the fights, by the end of the next 3 weeks of counts and recounts.
And after the lawsuits. Okay. Yeah. It's whatever happens.
You might know by the time of the next election who won the recall.
Yeah, that's funny. It doesn't, you know, like on this type of level, it's not going to stop me from believing in the death and resurrection of Christ,
right,
whoever that is. And it likely isn't going to stop my ability to tell other people about Christ, the death and resurrection of Christ, and to teach about it here on this podcast and all these other things. So there'd be a line there. Outside of that political realm, though, yeah, there's just it's a different type of apologetics that I think I'll find the episode we've done on presuppositionalism that tends to do this. It's typically done from a Reformed perspective. Their doctrine of election comes into play very much so when it comes to doing apologetics and essentially,
yeah, because only the elect are going to...
will ever understand.
Understand, yeah.
Van Til was sort of famous
We'll probably
for
get called out on that as incorrect, but as I understand it, that's true.
One of the reasons for tearing down the worldview is to show reveal. That a Christian... is to reveal that the Christian worldview is perhaps the only one in which the world we actually live in is coherent from that perspective. But
and the ones that will respond to it when you present it are going to be the elect.
But again, yes, certain people's eyes will be permanently covered from that truth. You know, and we would say, you know, the Holy Spirit works where he pleases when the gospel is proclaimed, but that is when the gospel is proclaimed, not when worldviews are destroyed.
Correct.
And so
that's a really good point to make.
And so, yeah, that's, I'm, you know, the working of the Holy Spirit wouldn't be based off of my rhetorical ability to tear down the incoherencies in somebody's
worldview. As fun as that might be.
Yeah. And it is fun.
As self-entertaining as such practices are.
So, yeah, it's just about holding some of these distinctions. And again, a lot of what we would find as political or ethics or philosophical in worldview construction and deconstruction, we would say belongs to the vocational realm, about how you deal with people, maybe decisions that you make in life, maybe where you shop, maybe who you vote for, you know, maybe where you live. All these sorts of things may be informed by that. And I wouldn't say you shouldn't have conversations with neighbors in your life that have to do with, quote, worldviews. But I don't think that's the tool that actually proclaims the death.
Well, that's a different conversation altogether. You know, the closer that you get to somebody, the more you get to know them, the more you can suss out what kind, especially if they're not a Christian, what kind of conversation would be most helpful to helping remove the obstacles on their way to the road to the cross.
Right.
So that's a different conversation than just us doing it sort of willy-nilly on 1517.
Yeah, without a particular person in mind on a show, right? Yeah. So I would say that. And then again, Christians engage in culture. I would say the reasons are sort of usually that Christianity is perceived as being under attack. Of course it's under attack. It's been under attack since day one. It's not a unique thing in our lives. And
well, the thing that we would do, though, is if you want that to change, we would encourage you to get involved individually.
Yeah.
In making changes, you know, voting, running for office, holding elected position, you know, whatever you think it would take to help make things better. We just don't advocate for the church being that entity. The individual, yes. The church, no.
Right. And I think that's great. That's a great summation of this. Well, great. Thank you for that question. That was a very good one.
Good start.
All right. So now here's a good one, a Melanchthon question.
Oh, I wonder who can answer it.
Yeah, I wonder if anybody could answer this. Basically, I'm just going to surmise this because it was a bit longer, and it was actually from somebody who's asked a question in the past that we answered. But it was, they're a newer listener to the Thinking Fellows podcast, and as we've been going through the Augsburg Confession and the Apology, they realized that they haven't heard much, if anything, about Philip Melanchthon before. And they're not a new Lutheran. They're just new to this podcast. So there's a couple questions here. You know, is that normal? Is it common for an LCMS Lutheran to never hear the words Philip Melanchthon?
Yeah.
Going through, like, confirmation, various Bible
Unfortunately,
studies?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay. So then the second part of that is the why. And then let's just address generally the why, if Melanchthon is important, or if Melanchthon is controversial, and that's why people haven't really heard of him, why are so many of the Lutheran confessions made up of works or writings or contribution by Philip Melanchthon? If he's this if his life is obscure, controversial, and sort of like going into his other works may be dangerous for you.
Yeah, that's interesting. I actually, the more I've thought about this question, the more I believe that the reason that most Lutheran laymen don't know the name Philip Melanchthon is simply because most Lutheran laymen stop learning about Lutheranism at Luther's Small Catechism. So they get Luther's Small Catechism either as a child or as an adult convert, and that's how they sort of make their way into Lutheran theology. And you know, unless your church does like a Sunday morning or a Wednesday night Bible study on the Augsburg Confession or something like that, you won't hear his name. Now, if your church ever does a study on the Augsburg Confession or the Apology, if you don't hear his name, you have to ask your pastor some serious questions, because that'd be just nutso. But if they did, you'll hear his name. But beyond that, I would also say that one of the bigger problems is most of Lutheran pastors haven't really read anything Melanchthon wrote other than probably the Augsburg Confession, and if they studied in their seminary classes, the Apology, and the...
Everybody in the LCMS would have had to read the Apology.
Powers and Primacy of the Pope. There's the more controversial reason why historically churches in the U.S. haven't really, and maybe haven't talked about Melanchthon purposefully was because the main sort of textbook that was used to train pastors on the Lutheran confessions, besides the Book of Concord itself.
So the history and context of them.
Yeah, it's called The Historical Introduction to the Book of Concord. It was written by a Lutheran theologian of the late 1800s named Bente. And it's actually, when I criticize it, I try to be careful because it's good, right? It's good and awful at the same time. Like it's a very easy date-to-date chronological walkthrough of the events that led to the writing of the various Lutheran confessions and the accumulating of the Book of Concord itself. But on the flip side of that, Bente hated Melanchthon, and wrote very, very negative things about Melanchthon. Some, I'd say it this way, some blatantly untrue, some misrepresented, and some true. But the fact that Melanchthon in Bente's eyes never got the benefit of the doubt meant that pastors who were trained using Bente for 100 years, more really, it's probably still being used in some seminaries, they never gave Melanchthon the benefit of the doubt either.
And even beyond the benefit of the doubt, I would say very, very likely were discouraged from reading the primary sources,
right,
as to find out if any of these interpretations were remotely correct,
right,
or not. And
now that started to change of late, right? So about 10 years ago, a new historical introduction to the Book of Concord came out, which is being used more in seminary classes and is more fair, written by a group of people that didn't all sort of see Melanchthon as the greatest enemy to the Lutheran Reformation or to Luther's legacy. And
I would say the two big critiques inside of Bente, and what if you were to ask a pastor trained during that era who hasn't read anything else about Melanchthon, you're going to hear that he was a crypto-Calvinist on the Lord's Supper, and that in his late life he sort of was like a free will theologian.
So you hear the two big ones are that he's a synergist and that he's a conciliarist, right? Those are the two big critiques. Now, crypto-Calvinist comes out too on the Supper. The synergism comes from some things that he wrote in the 1535 Loci that, if sort of read half sentence at a time out of context, would lead you to believe that he thought that a man's will prior to conversion
chooses to believe
and is a cause of conversion.
Yeah. And there's actually quite a bit of work for and against this in modern times as well. There's a book in the Oxford Theological Monographs, Evangelical Free Will. Then there's a handful of other books presenting the other perspective that, in fact,
The lay level, I did some just like lay level work on it in the meeting Melanchthon.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yes, true. You did. And that booklet is available, and I'll put that in the links here too. There are things. There's an ongoing conversation about what that later Loci interpretation is, and I would say there's at least it's underplayed how many people believe and have done work on the fact that he was not a synergist. And
oh yeah, it's dramatically. It's been even in my dissertation. I think it's been. I was able to show. So was I think it's Graybill in Evangelical Free Will. It's just not true. it's just an untrue statement to say Melanchthon was a synergist. The crypto-Calvinist stuff comes from his changing up of the Augsburg Confession and the various variatas, and sort of later in life, giving olive branches to reform groups that he thought could kind of lean more Lutheran.
And the American Lutheran Church has a particular beef with Reformed Church
because
Christians.
The Unionist movement in Germany that led to their migration from Germany to the United States, the LCMS particularly, historically came out of the forced Prussian Union.
Yeah, so errors in Germany, on the Lord's Supper that sort of say, hey, Lutherans and Reformed can get along, are unforgivable. They're unforgivable.
Yeah. The conciliar stuff has to do with him participating in the writing of the interim after the small colic war. We'll actually get into that in future episodes. So we've done it in the past too, in past episodes, so people can listen to that. But I would say this: if you are trying to become sort of an educated layman, Lutheran layman, there's been some really good work done on Melanchthon in the last decade. That's helpful. Some translations have come out of stuff that hadn't been translated before that's helpful. And we're not in the same situation that we were in even when I was younger, in my 20s. We're not in that same situation now. And I would suspect that in the years to come, you will hear his name more frequently. You'll never hear it on par with Luther and the Lutheran Church, but you will hear his name more frequently. I mean, we don't hear Martin Chemnitz's name that much either, which is kind of tragic too, right? So there's just this odd thing in the Lutheran Church, maybe it's because it's called Lutheran, I don't know, that you just hear about Luther. You know, Luther dies fairly early. There's a lot that happens in the Reformation and the generation just after the Reformation that defines Lutheranism that Luther is just not a part of because he's dead. And so the fact that, you know, if you were like our confessional writings, if you were to just take
word count.
Well, yeah, word count, but to take the small, large catechism and the small called articles, like you'd have a very thin book of confessions. But when you add in the Augsburg Confession, the Apology, Power and Primacy of the Pope, and the Formula of Concord, you get this very, very robust book of confessions. And those works were not written by Luther. You know, they were written essentially by Melanchthon and Melanchthon's students. And so, you know, we should hear his name more. The fact that we don't has some historical sort of background to it. That's changing now. We at 1517, can we announce it? I think we can.
I mean, let's just say there's some, like, if 1517 has anything to say about it, Melanchthon's going to get a lot more press in the coming years.
Yeah. You'll be hearing more soon.
Yeah. I mean, we try to say his name as often as I have an excuse to on the Thinking Fellows.
And on Outlaw
and
God.
And on Outlaw God. I will not, you know, I don't let two episodes go by without Paulson
having to say Melanchthon.
Having to say Melanchthon's name. I think,
that's
you
funny
know,
for Paulson.
It is funny. And for people over from sort of that, like, conservative evangelical segment of the Norwegians, like, you know, that's just rare. It's just more rare.
Yeah.
Like, even then for us. And so I think it's a fun project. And it's a fun project to recover the truth about Melanchthon and to sort of present it to a generation who is learning on formats like podcasts or at least has, you know, further learning sparked and interest sparked by things like podcasts and videos and conference talks where then we can, you know, in the future here, have an outlet for people whose interest is piqued to go get resources and maybe even do research.
Yeah. Yeah. So stay tuned.
Yeah. Stay
tuned. I hope we answered sort of the historical sort of ironies of why he's not mentioned a lot, but I do think it's changing and I do think we'll contribute to that changing for the better.
Yeah. And I have one more sort of add on here that goes on to this that, you know, that is basically if these things that are controversial about Melanchthon happened during his lifetime, things that his students would have known about, read about, we talked about how the Book of Concord was finalized sort of after Melanchthon's death.
20 years, yeah.
Right? So why, if he's so controversial, why if he makes these kinds of mistakes that people in good light can sort of help to explain and people in negative light can really shine as brightly as they want to on, why would you include his works in your final, like, grouping of confessions? Isn't there somebody who's less controversial who basically says the same things?
Yeah, I would suppose that even if he had completely fallen off the theological boat, you'd have to still include the Augsburg Confession, because even though he's the author, he was the author in consultation, and it was signed by evangelical princes and leaders. But that's not necessarily true for even the Apology, let alone the articles on the Power and Primacy of the Pope. And you would have expected the writers of the Formula of Concord to do a little bit more like specific calling out and correcting of him. Of him specifically in the formula and his errors specifically in the formula, if he would have been in such great error.
Yeah, if he was in grave error on the supper and if he was in grave error on election, you would think his name would be the one actually being refuted. Now, yeah. Philippism is.
Sure. That's not him.
And that's not him. And maybe that's something we could explain a little bit here too, is that some of these interpretations are probably true of Philippists.
Right.
And could you explain what a Philippist is?
A Philippist is somebody who sort of very intentionally says that during the sort of late Reformation era and into the post-Reformation era, that says we're intentionally not following just Luther or even just the confessions. We're just following the writings of Philip Melanchthon and the teachings of Philip Melanchthon. And they use everything he wrote, the sort of stuff that Melanchthon wrote that didn't make it into the Book of Concord, they use. Because I want to be clear, he said some stuff that I think he shouldn't have said. Whether or not that amounts to great error or makes him a Calvinist on the supper or a synergist, I don't think any of that. But he's worded some things in ways, and there's historical reasons why he did, worded some things in ways that I think are unfortunate and that people didn't understand what he was saying. You always face with Melanchthon that he's almost always smarter than the people he's teaching. And so he uses a nuance that he really understands and references that he really understands that not everybody does, and they sort of sometimes when you take what he says without the context, it means something different. And if you don't understand the context, you get a Philippist.
We've all met people like this who have a great teacher in their lives. And basically the only thing that they can do is they don't synthesize what they were taught.
Right.
But they try to copy that guy.
Parrot it.
Yeah. But when they parrot it, they're missing the salt that makes the thing actually come together.
So this does happen with Philippists on specifically the will and specifically on crypto-Calvinism. They do take sort of his changes on the supper, which were not good but were not completely erroneous, and they take it and they run with it. And
they're open-ended. I think that's how we should describe it, is that he leaves the supper open-ended in the way that he describes presence,
right,
by basically not describing presence. Yeah. Okay, so basically it's an omission.
By describing it in the Augsburg Confession and not describing it in the Variata.
Yeah, he just says, is present, and then, and like period, stop.
Right.
Versus like a specific type of bodily presence.
Truly.
Yep, truly. So that in the Variata you get an omission, in the later Locis when it comes to election and the will, he certainly does believe that there is a part of your salvation and election that is located in the will. The question is that generated by the will or by the Holy Spirit in the will?
The question is who's the mover?
Yeah,
and the mover still for Melanchthon is God. But if you don't understand how he's working that, you can suss out that maybe the mover is you.
Yeah,
and the Philippists do,
and I actually think there would be a way to read, and see. I think you could do this with anybody, because if you took Luther's sort of disposition to talking about clinging to faith, and he uses that phrase often to cling to faith, you made it a little more philosophical, you could explain cling to as a power within you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they both say things similarly to this that could lead you to believe that you have to do more than they say in other places, mm-hmm. right? Luther, this is true with Luther, too. I mean, if the will is supposed to cling to faith in order for me to be saved, there's a big question: whose motion is it?
Yeah, who's responsible for
causes
that?
Me to be able to cling? Mm-hmm. They would both answer God, but if you just stop at that, you must cling to. You can work that out as synergism.
You certainly, like a person who wanted to, could.
Yeah,
and that's the same thing that happens.
And the Philippists wanted to, and they did. He wasn't happy about it.
No. And two, man, this is kind of fun stuff. The Lochi changes in scope very dramatically, not only because Melanchthon's a tinkerer, but who he is in the Reformation changes big time from 1521 to the 1550s.
1521. he's not unknown, but he's not...
He's younger than me.
He's younger than you, and he's not known as a theologian necessarily. He's known as a
humanist,
a scholar of Greek, an author of a Greek grammar. Yeah. And in 1521, he sort of breaks out with this theological work, and it's highly acclaimed. And then he writes the Augsburg Confession, and then the Apology.
Well, then,
and from that point on, you know. He's asked theological questions at that point on, and the scope, you're right, the scope of the Lochi enlarges as his fame as a theologian enlarges.
And this too, you're handing you're doing this Lochi as like the first one, combating scholasticism, presenting a positive argument for evangelical descriptions of these doctrines, sort of going at Rome, going at these debates that are going on with Luther and hammering them point to point. You're now older. You've been teaching at the university for 10, 15 years, and people go, your Lochi is now a textbook. And you go, well, students who have never studied theology before need a doctrine of God that's not in that 21. I better get to writing. Oh, you know, I didn't write on this, and I didn't write on this. And if a student's going to have a complete education and know everything I know, he's going to have to read all these things.
Yep.
And that's not what the first one was.
Yeah, the first one is, I'm a fiery, hot convert to the Reformation. This is what you got to know.
And people don't view Melanchthon as that, right? They don't see Melanchthon as like the fired up young kid. Yeah.
That's what the 21 is. Literally, I'm a fiery, hot convert to this Lutheran Reformation, and this is what you got to know to be fired up like me. By 1559, you know, this is an old man trying to cover every base.
Because he's going to die soon, and this is what's going to be used to teach students for the next 100 years.
And this is what was used to teach students for the next 100 years. Not gonna, was used.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what you have to include is different.
Think about the scope of the man, too. His educational system has been used to educate people for 500 years. His theological textbook was used to educate pastors for at least 100 years. His Greek grammar was used to teach Greek in universities for almost 200 years.
Yeah.
This is... The listener's right. The fact that we don't know his name is kind of dumb.
Yeah, he had such a huge impact on human history. That it is silly, and it's silly that Lutherans have for a long time, with the exception of some very great and respectable people, not cared about setting the narrative either.
Yeah.
Like for a bunch of stuff, we've let like the Reformed set the narrative on Melanchthon.
Yeah.
No, thank you. I would like to own probably the second most important character of the Reformation for sure. And fight me, Calvinists. He's more important than Calvin. Like,
yeah.
So.
Lesser known, though, which lesser is known. Ironic.
But I think the scope of which he changed the world.
You know, the fact that he's lesser known is probably proof that he actually didn't diverge from Luther. Because if he would have actually diverged from Luther, you would have had Luther, Melanchthon, and Calvin instead of Luther and Calvin.
Right. That's true. Well, I think that seems reasonable.
Yeah.
But yeah, yeah, and a lot of his changes are just, like, uncredited.
Oh, a lot of his contribution to the Lutheran Reformation is uncredited.
Yeah, let alone his contribution to just, like, the general.
And I do think a lot of that has, I do, like I said at the beginning, I do think the unfamiliarity from the typical layman has to do with the fact that most lay education theologically stops with the small catechism.
And I think that's changing, though.
Yeah.
I think that's changing. I mean, we're trying to be a part of that change of 1517,
well,
right?
Well, our listener knew enough to ask the question.
So, yeah. Well, guys, this is fun. This became a Melanchthon episode, as always. This is that's the best way for an episode to transform.
That's funny.
We appreciate your questions. We appreciate your time
listening. Keep the Melanchthon questions coming.
Yeah, keep the Melanchthon questions coming. We can spend as many episodes as you want talking about that. And if you... If you have a question that you would like answered on air, you know, one of the things I do, you'll probably notice, is I don't use names on air. That way, if you do have a question that like is sensitive but not overly personal, I can still use those types of things. And we do appreciate it. And if you would just if you want to give any feedback or anything like that too, you can send me an email, and then you can go rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Even if you think it's a 4-star show, you can tell me why you think it's 4 stars and tell the world
iTunes
that it's 5. Yeah, that would be awesome. And yeah, thank you for listening. We will catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.